Welcome to the Herd Quitter Podcast. I'm your host, Jared Lumen. On this show, we talk to farmers and ranchers who aren't afraid to think for themselves and do things a little bit differently. We hope these guests will challenge you to look at your farms and ranches in a new way and result in a more profitable and enjoyable business for you and your family. Welcome back to the Herd Quitter Podcast. Today's guest is Duke Phillips of Ranchlands. Duke and his family have built a diversified ranching business across over 250,000 acres of the American West. And today we're going to talk to Duke and learn about how they did this and discuss the many aspects of his business that have allowed them to be successful. So Duke, welcome to the Herd Quitter Podcast.
Well, thank you. I've been looking forward to it.
Yeah, I have been as well. I was telling you a little bit earlier off the call that I think I a long time ago, before I heard the story more in depth, your ranch story, I'd watched your videos on YouTube, just like in awe, and on the History Channel, that they kind of followed you in some of your bison ranching and some of the work you've done. And it's just incredible. And ever since then, I never really thought I'd have the chance to talk to you, but here we are, and I'm looking forward to hearing your story. So if you wouldn't mind, I'd love to just kind of dig into your history, maybe even before we get into your ranch as it sits today. What's your history look like in the ranching business, and how did you get to where you are today?
Well, I am third generation. My grandfather and father are ranchers, and I've got two kids that are my partners, and then they have grandchildren. So five generations. I was born into ranching. My dad took his family to Mexico, and I was basically raised there until I was 14, I guess. And it was a ranch that was 3 hours or 5 hours from town, a horse culture, community of people just living and set back in time 100 years. Yeah, so I was raised in the old world, basically on horseback on a very remote, very large scale within a community of people that were indigenous in a lot of ways, just because they knew the medicinal qualities of the plants. And we made paintbrushes out of yucca plants, and we'd go out and get rocks and make whitewash. And so everything was, we had a fort, blacksmith, and made wagons from scratch. So I was really lucky to have been brought up and raised in that environment. And then high school, I was shipped to Dallas, where I entered a whole new world and thereafter, basically. But that's what got it in my blood, just being from that world.
Yeah. And talk about maybe at that time, was that kind of the common for that time? Or was that even, you kind of talked old world ranching, was that just a different culture set, and a lot of the other ranching industry was maybe a little more modern or different?
Well, that would have been the 60s, 70s, 80s. Okay. And, the United States was well on its way with infrastructure, town was very rarely that far away for us, being 5 hours from town and using horses instead of, gasoline powered trucks, whatever. So it was unique even back then. Yeah, pretty much so.
Yeah. And I'm not sure if I mentioned it. Did you say your family worked on that ranch, or that was a family owned ranch even at that time?
Well, my dad was a partner, working partner for investors who purchased the ranch. And so basically we lived on the ranch and were partners, working partners in it.
So you moved to Dallas. What happened from there?
Oh, man. I saw my first hamburger, my first bicycle, my first girl. Yeah, major change. It was a private school in Dallas, and so a whole strata of new experiences. And so I graduated from St. Mark's School, Texas, in Dallas, and went to college and the University of Puget Sound, University of Texas, and got a degree in creative writing and translation, because that was my first language, Spanish, of course.
Sure.
And then spent my 20s traveling, working on ranches all over the United States, Australia, Mexico. I wanted to be a writer for a long time and spent a lot of time writing, and finally ran to a guy from Chicago who had bought a ranch, was looking for a ranch manager, which I was in the planning stages of a horseback ride from Oregon to Argentina. I was going to write a book about cowboys around the world. So I got sidetracked with this guy. He said he was going to buy ranches all over the West and he was looking for a young guy like me. And so anyway, I went to work for him for 5 years and then left him and went to work for another company and for 10 years. And then an opportunity came up to lease a big ranch in Colorado, the Chico Basin Ranch, which is our corporate headquarters and outside of Colorado Springs. And that was a 25-year lease that I won. It was a competitive bid. And that started me on my journey as an independent rancher and the beginning of what has become Ranchlands.
Wow. Well, that's cool. I want to get more into Ranchlands, obviously, in the future. But your background, having grown up on a ranch and going to school for creative writing, and you wanted to be a writer, why did you choose to do all that traveling on ranches? Was your goal to write focused primarily on ranch land or on ranching? And did you see yourself getting back into ranching yourself, or what did that?
Well, at an early age, I debated whether or not I wanted to go to work in the corporate world and make a whole bunch of money and buy a ranch, which, you know, one viable alternative, or stay in ranching. And I elected to just stay in ranching. And I just loved, I can't really explain why, but I just, you know, I worked in Florida, I worked in Texas, worked in Oregon, worked in Mexico, and just Australia. And I was just basically having a good time traveling. And that was my way of traveling.
Sure.
I went to Europe at an early, you know, when I was 21 as a backpacker, and it was really lonely because all I was doing is traveling. And I decided next time I'd go somewhere and get a job and then meet people and then go visit them in their home. And that's what I did. And that just lasted for 10 years or, you know, however long till I was 30 anyway. Yeah. I mean, riding horses, seeing new country, meeting. My dad said, go to college and study under good professors and study stuff you like. And so I wound my way around through geology, through business, through accounting, and finally ended up with this teacher who was fantastic, Ronald Tobias, who became a mentor, and he was a writer. And so that launched me into that world. And so I was just traveling, you know, having a good time.
What are some of the things that you've learned in that experience? I imagine traveling all over and seeing how different things are done, there had to be something that maybe shaped your perspective on ranching and maybe what you're doing now as far as
your management. Along with studying with people that are smart and that you get along with and are interesting, you said get out of college and work for people who you want to learn from. And so I studied horsemanship under Ray Hunt. Anyway, there's about six people that I admired and I worked and followed them. I think all of them, what they had in common was a foundation that was based in doing something in a natural way. So the Lasseter family created Beefmaster Breed, and their philosophy, they founded a major breed in the United States, and their philosophy was produce an animal that is adapted to its natural environment. And that's genetically what you're going to select for. The horsemanship, Ray Hunt had a philosophy. It was very similar. It's tried to work within the horse as opposed to forcing him to do things, which is, you know, the old time way of doing things, handling livestock the same way. So I think that was a common denominator between everybody, is trying to figure out how we do things simply and close to, you know, nature as much as possible.
Yeah. And were some of those philosophies, did they have any alignment with how you were brought up, or did they kind of contrast what you had known?
I was brought up in the wild. I would take six or seven horses and I would go camping and I'd have the horses tied head to tail. And I'd just be gone for like 4 or 5 days. And I'd just go camp out and have my horses with me.
That's incredible.
So at an early age, I really had a deep respect and love for the wild, just being away by myself, middle of nowhere. And so, yeah, so I think there's a parallel there between, that's what led me to these people, I think.
Yeah. It's something that I here in Minnesota, I've always had this, I feel like almost this drawing to the West and this open spaces, kind of wild lands that really there isn't much of here. I can think of one place on the farms that we rent that I can stand and not see any civilization via, you know, power line poles, you know, houses, farms, roads, whatever. And so when you talk about that, it's just such an incredible thing to think about, and that, that, you know, getting out in nature.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a simple thing, but it's pretty profound, isn't it?
Yeah. Totally. When you shifted down that path working with that investor, did you ender, did you ever kind of circle back to writing, or did that kind of get put on hold as you, you went more into the ranching?
Yeah. I wanted to be a writer, a pilot, or a bush pilot, or a rancher. And so flying and writing got put aside, because this guy had a big, I actually worked for him. I worked on a ranch that he owned. And so he had his huge vision, you know, a ranching empire across the United States. And so that kind of, that blew me away and left everything else for that. But I learned what I refer to as, I got my PhD. He was a self-made multi-millionaire, multi-billionaire, I'm not sure what, in the real estate business. And a very, very hard-nosed and high expectations from. And so I learned a lot. That was my PhD in the business side of ranching.
Well, I imagine they always say it's not what you know, it's who you know. And having a connection like that, you probably learned as much as you ever could have had you gone to school specifically that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Wow. Great. And so what eventually caused you to look a different way of moving? You were working for him for 5 years, I think you said. Why did you decide to leave?
He was from outside the industry, I was raised in the industry, and there's just a lot of different ways of looking at things that didn't jive. And so I went to work for the Lasseter Ranch that was very much a leader, one of the leaders in cattle production. And I'd had enough of someone who I felt didn't really understand the business or the art of ranching.
Mm. So at this point, this, I think you said the Chico Basin Ranch, was that the name came up as an opportunity. Is there a reason why you at that point decided to go down the route of a lease as opposed to maybe a purchase or yeah. I mean, I don't know.
That's an easy question to answer. Okay. Purchase takes a hell of a lot of money, which I didn't. Sure.
Fair enough.
Way, way more money. I had been working for this family for 10 years, and frankly, I was bored. And this was an 80,000 acre ranch that gave me the opportunity to do what I wanted to do. I step out the door and I was on my place. I didn't own anything except, well, 7 horses, a truck, a trailer, and 20 cows. And it just allowed me to start that journey as an entrepreneur, you know, as an independent rancher.
So I'm curious, because I'm from Minnesota again, there's very little public land leases. It's private. You might get a lease from a bunch of different landowners. Can you explain how that works as opposed to competing for a lease and the length of time and, you know, how that works?
It's very common in the West for ranchers to be leased. So it could be ranchers who are retiring, ranchers who don't want to ranch. They don't want to be out doing it. There's absentee owners. There's agencies. The Chico was owned by the state of Colorado, or is owned, and they put an RFP out to the public. And basically it said, you got to be able to do these things and, you know, for this much money or however much money you can afford. So I went for it. And the other finalist was the Nature Conservancy, who I have become very, very close working. We have a very close working relationship now, I think, as a consequence of that. Because we manage a 110,000 acre ranch for them now as well. But you basically, it's just like a storefront. If you have a restaurant, you have a business and you need infrastructure. So it's the same thing. You lease the ground, and with it comes fencing and roads and watering system facilities for working, and a lot of times housing. And so it's basically set up to run a herd of cattle.
And a fear, at least here, is if we lease land from a landowner or a public landowner, that you're investing time and money into infrastructure to run cattle. And if you lose that lease, I mean, you said it was a 25-year lease, which I guess takes away a little bit of that risk, maybe. But is that a concern? After 25 years, do you have to recompete or do you have first opportunity?
Oh, very much a concern. Mm. Yeah, very much. And that's why we have grown, so that we just don't have one ranch. We have five ranches. And so that gives us a little bit of security. But yeah, I mean, that's just the name of the game. We have no choice. If we have a herd of cattle, and that's, we build our equity in the cattle herd over time. Mm-hmm. So that's how we build our wealth. And it's not by accumulation of land or hard assets. The cattle is the factory, and it has a value that if we want to sell it, it's a commodity and it's worth something.
Oh, that's interesting. It's almost counterintuitive, at least to this region, as to where people store their wealth. In the Midwest, I would imagine, or most people, I would say, imagine land as their primary wealth store, and cattle might be one tool to store small amounts. Yeah. But it's, your view is that the cattle is your long-term wealth.
Yeah, I mean, our business is such that we do not generate a high income. It's just a very, as you know, a very fine margin. And so we do it because we love it, and we can raise our families in a real wholesome way. And by increasing our equity in the cattle, in 20 years, we have a nest egg, or 30 years, whatever. So that's how we build our wealth. And now we have just purchased a ranch. We were fortunate enough to be in that position. So things have changed a little bit. Now we got a huge loan that we got to pay. We have a, you know, financial obligations that we, the scale of which we haven't had before. We also, one of the things that we do that I think is different than the straight out lease is that if a landowner has a ranch and they don't want to manage it, well, then what we will do, we will manage it for them. But instead of doing it for a fee, a cash fee, we will move an operation. So that means all the rolling stock, human resources, cattle, financing, administration, turnkey operation on their property, and we'll do whatever it is to accomplish their goals. So if that's creating a state-of-the-art ranch, you know, building infrastructure, if it means providing a safe haven, fun haven for a family once in, enjoy it, whatever the goals of the owners are, we will include them and make them foremost in what we do. And then we work out a trade in terms of, you know, the value of the ranch and the value of our management services, and come up with something that works for both of us.
Oh, that's just really interesting, like very unique way of looking at it. And if you work with a landowner who maybe has different philosophies on management of the land, have you had challenges with having to work through that?
Well,
or you,
I mean,
get
obviously our it's just like your wife, you know, you have to have be congruent in how you see things. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the first thing, is you have to think the same way. You have to look at things the same way. You have to respect each other and like each other. All those things have to all be in line. Mm-hmm. The biggest problem, or let's say roadblocks that we've had working with absentee owners, is fierce loyalty that landowners have to historical staff, regardless of how the relationship, or in some cases the staff, you know, has stolen from them, but they remain loyal. The other thing is that normally a landowner he'll already have a vision, or she. And so here we come in and we say, well, here's a good way to do things. And they're already on a path. And even if it's not working, it still has an emotional, you know, they're attached to it emotionally. And it's very, very difficult to come in to an existing community of owner and staff, or an owner that has a history and an idea of where they want to go. It's very difficult. But it's worked very well because the owners have been through the fire and they're looking for anything that will work.
Sure. Well, that was a question I had for you. When you get on these new ranches, especially if they're coming with some sort of previous management and staff in place, and you have a different philosophy, how do you work through those challenges with the new staff?
Our first goal is to employ the people who are there or who are in the community. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, if it's not impossible, it's damn near impossible.
Okay.
It's just, you know, people just get used to doing certain ways. And land and working on a ranch is so, it's just really I keep saying emotional, but it's really deeper than just, you know, analytical kind of making a decision, you know, practical decision or something.
Which is probably why you struggled with your previous job, is that he was coming from a business perspective and analytical and paper perspective, not this deep connection with land and livestock.
He had a very idealistic way of looking at things that were not real. Hmm. That was the biggest problem.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So you mentioned that, you know, as kind of as a way to put off risk, you've diversified and expanded your operation. And I think you mentioned 5 ranches. Talk about the 5 different ranches that you're running briefly, and how you came across them, and why you chose them. Well,
the first one is the one I told you about. That's what, how we got started in 1999. And then the connection with the Nature Conservancy and competing against each other for that ranch led to us working with them on the next ranch in Colorado, Mendo Zapata Ranch. And then there's been a ranches in between, but we have a ranch in New Mexico owned by a woman who is second generation. And a wonderful lady who loves us, and we love her, and it's a beautiful ranch. And we run a mother cow herd there. And then we have another family in Texas who have always leased their ranch out, and the previous lessees, for whatever reason, decided they want to go somewhere else. And so that was a competitive bid as well. And then the ranch in Wyoming is the ranch that we have purchased. It's a large ranch. It consists of federal land and a lot of a big creek running through it. And it's one of the most beautiful places you can imagine, and very rich, multi-layered in terms of facilities and natural resources.
When you get on, I mean, you're talking Texas, New Mexico, all the way to, you say Wyoming or Montana?
Oh, Wyoming.
Wyoming. I got to imagine there's a whole lot of differences in those ranches. When you get on a property, and there's probably differences within every given property too, how are you evaluating? What's the process when you get on a new property that you've just acquired a lease on or a purchase, where you start evaluating this property and how are we going to manage this? How are we going to run this?
Well, it sounds difficult, I guess, because of the scale. It's, you know, almost 300,000 acres altogether, but it's what we do. It's what we've always done, and it's what we get up every day. And so there's a lot of common, you know, overlap between ranches. Yeah, they all have watering systems and they all have fences, and you can stock them depending on how much rainfall you have. But I think the biggest leg up that we have is we have a ranch management training program that we started in 2000, the Ranch Lands Management Guild. And it trains young people who are interested in managing ranches to become leaders on a ranch. And all the ranches that we run are run by people that have come to us, most of who have never been on a ranch before, who are now full-scale managers. So when you know somebody like you do, they'll work for us for X number of years, depending on how fast they develop. And during that process, we know them really well, and they know us. We know their strengths, and we know what they're not good at or not as good at. And that helps a lot. Makes a big difference. You know, we know how to communicate. We have systems in place that they know. So it really facilitates everything.
And then logistically, you talked about like water fence infrastructure. Mm-hmm. I mean, are you, especially on these leased grounds, are you coming in and do you invest into that infrastructure if it's necessary, or will you work with what's there? And
we always start with what's there. And obviously we're, as ranchers or professional ranchers, we operate on a very economic efficient level. In other words, we don't buy brand new trucks. We're hoarders. We pull an old fence post up. We put it in the stack and reuse it. Sure. You know, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I mean, that's just hard to describe, I guess, in detail. It's just a lot of commonality, and we'll invest. It just depends on the relationship. And if we have a long-term lease, well, obviously you can afford to invest in it. It's a big difference, you know, between a 5-year and a 25-year lease. Sure. But most of the time when you have a ranch that you lease, the owner usually pays for the material, and the lessee pays for the installation. So we invest our time, and they invest in the whatever it is, like the fence post and wire.
And then the labor side of it there, the management side that you talked about, how active of a role do you have in the actual management of these properties? Or is it a fairly hands-off after you've worked with the new manager and worked them into the property and developed a plan?
It's very hands-off. My son is a full partner he's a 33, and my daughter is a full partner. She's 34. My son runs all the ranches. My daughter runs everything else. And I'm involved. I run one ranch that I live on, and I'm involved more at the strategic level. And of course, I participate a lot in everything, but my son pretty much runs everything. And the people we have are great. And we don't have to be there every day. We also use aircraft. My son has a helicopter, and that's very useful in monitoring and covering a lot of ground. And then we also have fixed wing aircraft to get us between ranches. So we can be, instead of a 10 hour trip, we'll be there in a couple hours.
For managing properties as far as you are and as vast areas, I'm sure that's very, very useful. So ranch lands, at least on the website, it looks like, when I was kind of looking into it, is more than just land and cattle management as well. Mm-hmm. You've got other aspects of your business that you've diversified into. Can you talk about those different enterprises?
Well, when I first leased the ranch, I didn't know how I was going to pay the lease because I didn't own any cattle. Mm-hmm. And so I started thinking, okay, what kinds of things can I do to increase the revenue? So I said, okay, well, we'll try to get people to pay us to come out and work with us. And so I started the whole hospitality business, which has grown significantly. One of the ranches that we run for the Nature Conservancy has a 17-bedroom lodge with a full staff of wranglers, chefs, naturalists, so on and so forth. ZRanch.org. I mean, so everything that we do is basically started from figuring out, okay, how can we earn more income? Mm-hmm. And so we brought artists out to paint, and then we had an exhibit and said, okay, well, we'll charge a little commission to make something there. And then we started having concerts and say, well, okay, we'll charge tickets and we'll make burritos. And that started our concert series. And what is interesting is that those kinds of endeavors turned into a non-financial gain, but more of a mission related, how do we build bridges between people in town and people who live on ranches to try to preserve our legacy in ranching and try to have people understand that we're not just a bunch of people running around shooting guns in the air and galloping around like John Wayne, but we're actually, ranching is one of the most compelling alternatives to large scale conservation in the West. We have 2,000 kids or 2,000 people come to our ranches annually to our education program. So all these things, a lot of these things that we started out as ideas to try to bolster our financial bottom line have turned into more of a mission related. How do we save the world through ranching? How do we save ranching through saving the world kind of thing? Mm. The diversification in hospitality has been not only a business, has turned into a good business for us, but more and more we see it as important. As importantly, it's become a way to meet people and, you know, it created a family of people who can see really what ranching is and what it can do, and then support that as we go out and try to create a better world through grazing and ranching.
Yeah, and that was something that was clear just looking at your website is that it's more than just a business. It's you're telling your story, you're sharing your story. Mm-hmm. Where did that stem from, that desire to share the story? You know, it sounds like it maybe evolved partially from little things, but at some point there had to be an intentional decision as like, this is something we want to do.
Yeah, that's interesting you say intentional, because a lot of people ask me that. And it really, we did not start off by saying, well, we're going to do all these things that we are today. It has been an organic, if you will, metamorphosis as we just And I credit a lot of that because we're an economic, we're for profit. And so the decisions we're making, we're trying to stay afloat and how to maintain our family. And I think that's a really important thing, especially in a poor business like ranching is.
I like how you openly accept poor business like ranching is, yet you've devoted your life to this business.
Oh, yeah, but no one has as much fun as we do.
Yeah, there's the truth, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I mean that. It's really, I mean, we wouldn't be doing it, obviously, if we didn't enjoy it. And I mean, who gets to take their kids out on horseback with them and out in the truck when they're knee-high or grasshopper? And they grow up out there with you, and you know, you have all that amazing opportunity to talk to them about everything that's going on, as opposed to when they get back from school, or you know, when they get back from playing with their kids down the street or whatever.
It is such an incredible opportunity. I mean, you're right, and yet you've done more. I mean, you've taken this business that, you're right, over the whole is probably break even at, you know, or worse. and you've made a successful business out of it, starting with something that I skipped over that you mentioned there that got me, you know, I realized I should have dug more into. You started with nothing, 20 cows and a few horses in the truck. How did you take it from 20 cows and you just leased an 80,000 acre property? Well, first of all, what were you thinking? Like when you said, oh yeah, this seems like an opportunity. I was
happy to have my own place. I mean, I was ecstatic. I mean, walking out the door and 80,000 acres to go play in every day, no one to tell you what to do. I mean, the only way that I could do it is to take in other people's cattle. So cattle owners also lease land, and I provided care. So, and then I started buying a few cows and I tucked them in the corner, and then I started doing little things and gradually got to a point where I owned all the cattle, and your per unit margin increases, you know, by factors once you own the cattle versus someone else's. And, you know, one step at a time. And, you know, my focus was not trying not to make too big a mistake. not going out and trying to make as much money as possible, but just trying not to make one that's going to knock me out.
Yeah. So I want to dig into that more, because there's a ton of people, and listening podcasts, looking at my like demographics, the majority of the listeners are, I think, under age 35, kind of young, more so in the beginning ranching range. Maybe a lot of them come from ranches already and they've got their futures locked in, but I got to imagine there's quite a few people who maybe don't have a, you know, a future locked down and are looking to get into this business.
Yeah.
You started from nothing and have built what is today over, you said around 300,000 acres, owning quite a bit of land and cattle, and you started from scratch, and you've kind of given us some broad things, but when you started out, can you give any more context to those early days? Maybe how you worked with some ranchers to bring in cattle. Was it stressful working through that? You know, share some of that.
Well, I worked for a ranching family and had contacts through them. It was the last of their ranch, and they founded the Beefmaster breed. We had wholesale. So I met cattlemen from all over the country. So I knew, if I didn't know them, I knew all of them. I knew all the major players. And so I also had a really strong foundation in working a ranch, you know, just the logistics. And I knew that I didn't want to have a whole bunch of little cattle owners running around. And so I went out and found large herds and offered a very competitive price just to get my foot in the door. And so, you know, I'd have semis arrive and unload 500 head and take them out to this ranch, and then 800 head to another part of the ranch and like that. And so I dealt with four or five people, and I gave them a really, really good service, honest service, and a fair service. And their cattle perform well. And so gradually I could increase my prices and save my money. And instead of putting it in the stock market, I put it into cattle. Every penny I made outside of subsistence living, you know, buying food and whatever, you know, basic needs, was put into cattle. And over time, it has a way of growing. You know, you keep as many females every year, and that increases your herd by X percent. And after, you know, we've been in business 20 years, we own all the cattle now.
Yeah. It's a cool story. It reminds me of Greg Judy and kind of the no risk ranching kind of business model that he employed, bringing in other cattle on leased land to build a business to where he got to a point of owning cattle. And yet I've never heard that story of you. You look at the website and it looks like you just have this massive operation that I think so often can overlook the beginnings. And it, yeah. It yeah. was a,
that's a good was, point. An oversight on our part anyway.
No, it's really interesting. I appreciate you sharing that with me.
I think the other part of it is just, you have to really be of very, very low cost, no new trucks, all the trucks we own are disposables, we call them, you buy them for $1,500 and, 5-10 years later, you've disposed them.
You got your money's worth out of them then. If you can get 5 years out of 10 years out of a $1,500 truck.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not using exact figures, but mm-hmm. you get the idea. You just buy racks and you just keep them going until they won't run anymore.
Yeah. Good wisdom there to not buy into the new paint disease. Yeah. Is there anything else on kind of your startup story that you would share, something that has been keys to your success in starting? Cause I don't know what the percentage is. Is it like 70% of businesses fail in the first 3 years or whatever that number is, and you've made it past that.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. The best fertilizer for the land is the owner's footsteps. And so I think that's really important. If you're going to do it, you got to be out there doing it. You got to live on it. You got to get up every morning and prioritize everything that needs to be done. And the older I get, the more important I think it is to believe that whatever it is that you're doing is going to work no matter what. And it's just, coaches in football and sports are always talk about, the mental part of the game is the most important part, and why sports are so important, and preparing young people for real life. And I really believe that. I believe that if you get up every morning, no matter what it is, you think you're going to do it, and you fall down, you get knocked down, you get back up, and you don't budge. You just keep your head down. It's going to work. I really believe that, especially if you like it.
Oh, that's true. Good point. You mentioned earlier, and I don't remember what you had said exactly, but something about like ranching is one of the best conservation tools. I'm paraphrasing mm-hmm. something along the lines of that. How have you managed your land in a way that puts conservation first and improved mm-hmm. land and been intentional about that?
Have you heard of Alan Savory?
Yes.
So Alan Savory is my hero. He's one of the most influential figures, I think, the most important conservationist in the world today. And I went to he's one of the people that I studied under. And so his idea is, how do you emulate the way natural ungulate herds, in history, millions of bison, millions of wildebeest, whatever it is, how do you emulate their grazing and how do you mimic the symbiotic relationship that they had with the great grasslands of the world? And so just very quickly, a bison herd in the, back in the 1800s and before would go across the ground, and they would defecate, urinate, and they would, what they wouldn't eat, they would tromp down onto the ground surface so that it would recycle, it would rot back into soil matter. And so the ground needed the bison herd effect as much as the bison needed the grass. And then they would leave because it would, they ran out of food and be raining somewhere else and growing somewhere else. And they wouldn't come back till months or years later when everything had completely flourished. And so what we try to do is mimic that by putting all the cattle into one herd and rotating them in a migratory fashion around the ranch so that you get the effect of the hooves in the herd. And most importantly, you rest everything that you've grazed during the growing season, especially, it's important. And so over time, diversity increases, the water cycle increases, the organic recycling of plant material, sequestration of carbon. Over time, it takes a lot of time because it took a lot of time for it to degrade. It changes. And the reason we say ranching is the most compelling alternative to large-scale conservation is because The other alternative are NGOs that, you know, environmental NGOs that have to go, that are all nonprofit, have to go out and raise the money. And then they have to convince people who give them the money to, and the people who are giving them money, you know, have certain things they want accomplished. And so it's this quagmire in some ways, but a very positive thing. Whereas ranching, the cattle provide the economic means. And you have people that are living on the land already. And even though ranchers in some circles have a bad rap, all the ranchers I know are thinking about the environment. It's kind of like brushing their teeth. They just don't think, you know, it's not a conscious thing. You're thinking about how you're going to feed your cattle and the wildlife and support them, the environmental systems that are out there. And so that's why we say, you know, you have a community of people, you have the economics, and then you have the desire to create something better for your children in the future. It's kind of a long-winded response, but
no, it's great. It's a big question. I mean, you're talking about conserving and improving degraded lands that have been degraded for, you know, decades, if not centuries. Yeah. It shouldn't be a quick, well, we do this. Yeah, right. So no, yeah. I appreciate that. And what does that look like logistically on the land as far as you're moving them?
Well, moving them is the easy part. It's paying for the infrastructure, because traditionally what ranchers have done is they put small groups of cattle and spread them across their ranch and pastures that they live in most of their lives. And they might, they'll rest them as much as possible. So the water requirements for a small group of cattle is much different than putting all the cattle into one herd. And that's sure. quite significant in cost. So the outlay of money to get a place, the infrastructure up to, you know, high rate flows, water, you know, for your watering points. Electric fence, the technology is evolved, is fantastic. And so that's not costly. We can put up a single strand. We can train our cattle and they can respond to a single strand that we can put out and pick up, you know, in a few hours. And it doesn't disturb wildlife at all. And then you train the cattle. The cattle are not dumb. It's amazing how you can have a herd of, say, 1,500 cows in a pasture that's 800 acres. Or even 2,000-3,000 acres, 5,000. And when you open the gates to a herd that's used to moving, you can ride from that gate all the way back 2 miles to the back of the pasture, and most of the cattle will be moving up without you having called them or sent them a signal. And sometimes the siren works. Sometimes you call the first cow and she moves, and the next one moves, and they move. They move all the way back to the back, and everything knows what's going on. So the cattle handling is the easiest if you try to work, you know, with them. It's the cost of the infrastructure that's prohibitive sometimes.
Yeah, and that water, you know, and being in this area, water is not the concern that it is out there. And so right, yeah. that challenge, it yeah, I'm sure it's real. Are you running on any sort of irrigated land where you have that additional challenge of water rights and water, or is it just getting the water to the cattle that's the main concern with water?
Both. The ranch that we had most recently brought into our circle has a lot of irrigated ground, and we, instead of haying it, we're grazing it.
Huh. Talk about that. I mean, that's obviously an intentional decision that's unusual probably for the area.
Yeah, it's pretty cool actually. We have these amazing fields that have pivots and irrigated gated pipe. And we're running, our stock densities would be, I don't know, 100 cows to an acre, maybe, or 100 head. So it's very high densities.
Yeah.
And the real art of grazing starts with creating a very specific detailed plan. And so knowing how many animals you have, how many units you're going to remove, what's the sequence you're going to take to make it easy to move that many cattle from one place to another? How much rest are you going to create? What kind of monitoring system are you going to create to make sure you're making the right decisions? What are you going to do if the shit is the fan, you know, in terms of nutrition or sickness or, you know, an unforeseeable? The biggest unforeseeable for us was how much they grew. And all of a sudden we have 4-weight calves that are turned into monstrous beasts that all they want to do is eat. Mm-hmm. And belch. So, you know, we had contingency plans for if we overconsume what we had projected, and we've learned. And so you take grazing records, actual, you know, what actually harvested, and next year we're going to be a lot better.
And I'm sure most people in that area use those irrigated pivots to make their feed for winter. How are you managing through winter then by grazing those irrigated pivots?
Well, we won't have cows.
Okay.
Seasonal grazing. So we'll take a vacation in winter.
Sure. And where do the cows are seasonal custom grazed cows, or you're just moving them to another location?
Or mostly yearlings. So we bring them in from all the other ranches as of 3 and 4 weights, and then ship them as 7 and 8 weights.
Okay. So you're essentially, is this Montana ranch has essentially sort of become your background stocker operation for the rest of the ranch cow calf enterprises?
That's how we started. We just haven't bought into the, you know, raising hay and then feeding it to cows as opposed to, you know, irrigating and letting the cows or the cattle harvest it. That makes more sense to us.
No, I completely agree. And that's just really interesting how you thought through, rather than just continue to expand cows and try and cram cows into an environment where it really maybe didn't make sense, you've utilized that ranch to complement your cow-calf businesses in other areas.
Yeah.
That's great. I really appreciate you sharing all that. Is there anything else, overarching concepts, thoughts that you would want to share as we kind of start to wrap up this conversation today that
I guess there's a lot, but then we covered a lot as well. I'm sure we think a lot of things.
Yeah, that's the problem with this is I could talk for hours and try to cram it into roughly an hour, but
I don't know. I mean, I guess the big thing for, you know, education is a really big important thing for us, and not only people who want to have a career in ranching, but also kids that are growing up in cities who have no idea what a ranch is and, you know, what cowboys do, and who think that any animal that wears horns is a bull. And so I guess I would just offer anybody that might be listening, if they want to contact us for any questions or help, we're all about that. And we would love to, you know, may not be able to answer all the questions, but certainly do our best to give you our thoughts anyway.
Yeah. So where can they find you? How can they reach out? And then is there anything you want to plug? I know you mentioned like concert series, you do some tourism things. What kind of things that you would maybe want to share with the listener?
Well, my email address is duke@ranchlands.com. And so I can be emailed there. If anybody wants to visit, we have a hospitality services that can be found at ranchlands.com. Zranch.org is another website. We have an online magazine, ranchlandsreview.com. It has a lot of, you've seen probably we have photographers and cinematographers who work. And so we created a lot of film, and there's just a lot of content there, either prose or film or still photography. And we also have a leather shop that we create good consumer goods, ranchlandsmercantile.com. And that's another diversification where we've taken the leather craft, the art of leather craft in American tradition, and been making things for a while in our shop. So anybody who'd be interested in that, so cool stuff there.
Yeah, I had looked at it earlier and I got my eyes on some things. So I appreciate you sharing that. Last question for you. You mentioned education and the importance of education, and you talked about Alan Savory and some resources already, but if you had to recommend 2 or 3 resources for a rancher, you know, age 27 to 35, you know, like a lot of our listeners are, and really just anybody interested in doing what you do, what would you recommend?
There's several organizations. Western Landowners Alliance is a good organization for learning more about the issues and solutions in the American West. Kavira Coalition is a great organization with a summit every year in November. Those are probably the two groups And of course, there's other resources and people if someone has a specific problem or specific challenge that they're dealing with. I know people that are professionals can help professionally with whatever. If anybody has a ranch that they would like to, a large ranch especially, we would be very happy to learn more about it and see if there might be a way to work together.
I really appreciate you taking some time to talk to me today, sharing your information, your wisdom, and your experience and your story. It was really great. I would encourage anybody who has more questions most definitely to reach out to you, and we'll share that information in the show notes. So thank you so much, Duke.
Well, sure. I appreciate your interest. It's been fun talking, and wish you all luck in the world too. And when you come out this way, come visit.
I will. It's most definitely on my bucket list. Yeah.
All right. Well, you take care of yourself. Thanks
you
a lot.
Thank you.
The Herd Quitter Podcast is brought to you by Faro Cattle Company, whose mission is to help ranchers put more fun and profit into their business. You can get more information on Faro Cattle Company at farocattle.com. And if you enjoy what you've heard on this podcast, be sure to subscribe and check us out on Facebook and Instagram at Herd Quitter Podcast or at herdquitterpodcast.com.